Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the Voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Technology Report and This is America, coming up after As It Is.
Hello again and welcome back. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington with As It Is. It's a program that helps you learn and improve your American English and tells you about our world. Today, we begin with a question that has been asked by scientists for many years. Some of the largest animals to ever live on Earth quickly disappeared. When did this happen? More importantly, why did it happen? Let's try to answer those two questions on today's edition of As It Is. Then, more news from the world of science. Are robots taking over our planet? It may sound like something from a movie, but the story we have for you today is true. Robots can now build themselves. You won't want to miss this one. Let's get started with part one. Dinosaurs last lived on Earth about 65 million years ago. For many years, scientists have debated how and why dinosaurs disappeared. But improved tools and records of fossil remains have led some experts to agree about the disappearance of these ancient creatures. We get more from Jerry Watson.
University of Edinburgh researcher Steve Brusati led the team of experts. They blamed a huge rock from space, a 10-kilometer-wide asteroid, for the dinosaurs' disappearance. Steve Brusati says the rocky object was responsible for environmental damage worldwide. He says the asteroid caused tsunami waves, earthquakes, wildfires, acid rain, and sudden temperature changes. Mr. Brusati and his team proposed that if the asteroid had struck the Earth a few million years earlier, the dinosaurs might have been better able to survive. By the time the asteroid struck, dinosaurs had already lost some of their strength.
A lot of the big plant-eating dinosaurs, those horned dinosaurs like Triceratops, the bottom of the food chain dinosaurs, the base of dinosaur ecosystems, those dinosaurs had declined a little bit in their diversity.
He notes that dinosaur populations had grown and then decreased in number over 150 million years. His team's report appears in the journal Biological Reviews. But some plants and animals did survive through the period of dinosaur extinction. Another study looks at one group of dinosaurs that lived through the disasters. It shows how large, cold-blooded, meat-eating animals like Tyrannosaurus rex may have developed into small, warm-blooded birds. Biologist Michael Lee works jointly with the South Australian Museum and the University of Adelaide. He was the lead writer of the study. He and his team centered their efforts on one group of dinosaur, meat-eating theropods. They examined 120 species. One group of dinosaurs was evolving, changing four times as fast as all the other dinosaurs living during that period. And over time, the fast-evolving group became birds. The scientists studied how those changes took place over 50 million years. They say that during that time, each generation got smaller and smaller. Michael Lee says that by the time the asteroid hit, the earliest birds had been living for about 100 million years.
The bird ancestors started exploring a new type of lifestyle which involves smaller body size, greater agility, and greater ability to regulate their body heat using things like feathers and various other things.
Mr. Lee said smaller body size was responsible for the changes, and that, in turn, would have made way for changes in their body structure, like the addition of wings and flight feathers. He also noted other changes seen in modern birds, such as wishbones. About 10,000 species of birds now live on the planet.
You are listening to VOA Learning English, and we are coming to you from Washington. Origami is the Japanese art of shaping paper to look like animals, flowers, and other objects. Now, Harvard University scientists have modeled or created a robot on the ancient art form. They have made designs that robots can follow to put themselves together. Mario Ritter has more.
Sam Felton builds robots. The Harvard graduate student works at the university's micro-robotics laboratory. His most recent creation is a robot 18 centimeters wide and 15 centimeters long. It has four moving legs and looks like a crab. Sam Felton spoke to VOA on Skype.
We started with a desire to make robots as quickly and cheaply as possible. And so we looked to origami in order to find ways to create very complex and functional machines. Mathematically, origami can create almost anything you'd want, but the trick is to actually get it to happen in real life with real materials.
Mr. Felton starts with what are called shape memory polymers. These are flat plastic sheets that change shape when they are heated. Electronics placed between the layers or levels of material are programmed or set to start the folding action. A battery provides the power.
And we supply these with current, much like you'd supply a light bulb with current. And that heats up that local area to above 100 degrees Celsius. Once it hits 100 degrees Celsius, the shape memory polymer shrinks, and that pulls on the paper, causing it to fold over.
The paper starts folding itself within 10 seconds.
And as soon as that brain is told to start running, it goes through the process of telling each circuit to turn on or off. And then once it knows that it's assembled, it tells the robot to walk forward.
It takes about 4 minutes for the robot to assemble itself.
What we showed here is that you could embed all these systems onto an autonomous robot and cause it to control its own folding.
Mr. Felton wrote about his work in the journal Science. He says the process permits researchers to quickly produce complex robots that can build themselves into different sizes, depending on what they must do. The robots are also strong for their weight. One valuable quality is that self-building robots can be shipped flat in large numbers, then unfold themselves where they are needed.
I like to think about assembling in space. If you could send a ream of flat sheets up that then turn themselves into satellites, or even send that ream to another planet and have it turn itself into a new base.
Sam Felton says such machines have other possible uses. They could, for example, be placed in the narrow spaces of a collapsed building and unfold themselves to look for and rescue people. I'm Mario Ritter.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Thank you for listening to our program today. We are here 7 days a week, to help you learn and improve your American English. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Technology Report is next, followed by This is America. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Technology Report. The Internet is one of the most popular forms of technology. But can using the Internet have the same effect as taking a drug? The answer seems to be yes in at least one country. China says many teenagers are Internet addicts. It says they have grown dependent on the Internet. In fact, China feels that Internet addiction is the biggest threat to its teenagers. Some critics even call the Internet electronic heroin. In 2008, China became one of the first countries to declare Internet addiction an official medical condition. Experts released a report that defined the condition, or disorder. It said people with Internet addiction disorder spend more than 6 hours online doing something other than work or study. Based on the definition, China has over 20 million Internet addicts. The condition has led to the creation of over 250 camps within China. They are designed to treat young addicts. The first addiction camp opened in 2005 in the capital, Beijing. The camps treat the country's young addicts for their dependence on the Internet and video gaming. Teenagers can spend 3 to 4 months at a camp. Once there, the patients are required to do demanding physical exercises and take medication. Some patients reportedly are placed in rooms by themselves for up to 10 days. Eric Harwit is a professor of Asian Studies at the University of Hawaii. Professor Harwit says Chinese parents are worried because they take education very seriously. He says they saw a lot of teenagers start to lose interest in school and spend their time playing games on the Internet. Shosh Shlom and Hila Medalia are filmmakers from Israel. They released a documentary called Web Junkie last month. It tells about the Internet addiction camps. Their film was produced at the Daqing Treatment Center in Beijing. Hila Medalia says there are no showers at the camp. The teenagers wake up very early in the morning. She says it is like the addicts are doing military training. But Ms. Medalia says camp officials believe conditions like these provide a discipline, or sense of self-control, that the patients need. Officials at the Daqing Treatment Center said that 70% of their patients overcame Internet addiction. Eric Harwit says, once the teenage patients leave the camp, they are not supposed to play games, but they still have to use the Internet. He says a lot of research is now done online. China is not the only country dealing with Internet addiction. South Korea has opened over 100 treatment centers for teenagers suffering from the effects of electronic heroin. And that's the VOA Learning English Technology Report.
Welcome to This is America from VOA Learning English in Washington, where we teach you how to speak everyday American English. I'm Christopher Cruz. Today, we talk about a game that many people love but few have heard of. It is the sport of ultimate frisbee.
Ultimate Frisbee combines many of the skills and strategic thinking of basketball, American football, and soccer. But players do not move a ball down the field. Instead, they throw and catch a frisbee, that disc-shaped object that floats through the air. Maybe there is something special about playing with a frisbee. Although the game is similar to other sports, Ultimate Frisbee, usually just called Ultimate, has an unusual culture. For one thing, players are not firm about enforcing rules. Take DC Pickup. This group plays on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Every workday, anybody who wants to play meets on the mall near the carousel. An ultimate field is a little longer and a little narrower than a soccer field. But DC Pickup does not have that much space. So instead, one of the players uses cones to mark a field about half the size. In a few minutes, more people start arriving. A lot of them are on bicycles. One woman brings her dog and ties her along the sidelines.
The aim of the game is to get a teammate to catch the frisbee in the other team's goal area. Each goal is 1 point. The first team to get 21 points wins, or 15 points, or whatever number of points the teams agree to. DC Pickup does not even play to a set number. The players stop when it is time to go back to work. The official number of players for an ultimate game is 14. Sometimes DC Pickup plays with fewer. And if more people come, they just start a new game.
Everybody, we're up to 7-on-7. Can we leave the field?
Everyone brings a dark shirt and a light shirt, so they can change teams if they need to. Shauna Wallace has been playing Ultimate since 1982. She says the lack of equipment makes Ultimate one of the easiest sports to organize.
All you need is a pair of cleats, a frisbee, and some cones. You don't even need the cones.
There is one other thing you do not need: referees. Ultimate is self-officiated. That means players make all the calls. And if the players disagree, they must settle the problem themselves.
If one person says foul, the other person says contest. If it's contested, it goes back to the thrower.
In fact, playing fair, more than playing to win, is really the only rule in Ultimate that cannot be changed. Players call the trust between players to do what is right the spirit of the game.
I mean, one of the cool things about Ultimate is that that is in the rules, the spirit of the game and the ability to self-officiate. It's written into the rules, and if you can't abide by that, then you really shouldn't be playing the sport.
I'm a new soul. I came to this strange world hoping I could learn a bit how to give and take. But since I came here, felt the joy and the fear, finding myself making every possible mistake.
Dan Roddick was one of the first Ultimate players back in the 1970s. He was so tall, the other players called him the Stork. He says that Ultimate, like other disc sports, has always been kind of unusual. What does that mean? First, a lot of Ultimate teams have unusual names. Examples include Kamikaze or Gravity Tractor. Dan the Stork Rotic says many teams also wear unusual costumes.
Berkeley Flying Circus was one of the greatest, and they played in full clown gear. The rubber noses, the fright wigs, everything.
The Stork says one reason the sport of Ultimate is unusual might be because of the Frisbee itself. He says the first Frisbee, called the Pluto Platter, had a message written on the back.
The old Pluto Platter, the first disc that came out in the late 50s, it said, play, catch, invent games.
The disc even looked like something out of people's imaginations.
It was like a little spaceship. It had little windows around the top, and then the planets were engraved on the outer edge of it. Out of the disc.
Because Frisbees urged people to create games, the Stork says lots of children invented Frisbee sports. One of those children was Joel Silver. As a boy, he played a game that he called Ultimate Frisbee. When Joel was 16 years old, he suggested that his school start an Ultimate Frisbee team. He and his friends wrote down the rules and taught other kids to play. In 1970, Joel's high school played the first Ultimate game against another high school. 2 years later, two college teams played against each other for the first time in a game of Ultimate. The colleges were Princeton University and Rutgers University.
Dan the Stork Rotic was a player for the Rutgers team. He was 25 years old and a graduate student in sociology. His team had been playing together for only 2 months, but other students had heard about the game. Reporters also heard about it. So when the Stork looked up from the field, he saw 1,000 people watching.
They were super into it. I mean, they kind of treated it like football. They on every time there was a throw off, and that noise drew even more crowd.
The first college Ultimate game was exciting because the sport was new, and it repeated history. Rutgers and Princeton played the first college football game on exactly the same day more than a century earlier. And in 1869, as in 1972, Rutgers won.
There were lots of really, really weird things that went down that day, and we were just reeling at the end of that. We thought, oh my gosh, this is it's going to be Monday night Ultimate on major stations by the end of the month. You know, it's wild.
Ultimate never became as popular as Monday Night Football in the United States. Instead, it mostly remains what the Stork calls alternative. In other words, Ultimate does not try to be like other sports. And it welcomes a lot of different kinds of players. In that way, Ultimate is a product of the culture of the 1960s when it was invented. At that time, many Americans were protesting the country's involvement in the war in Vietnam. They wanted Americans to work together peacefully. They also wanted to have fun. So Ultimate became a friendly sport without any officials telling players what to do. But that does not mean the players are not serious competitors. Here is the Stork talking about one team in California.
You see these guys come out there, you think, oh, wow, you know, this is going to be just completely lighthearted. And the fact of the matter is that they were fantastic athletes, and they were playing with as much dedication and commitment to winning that game as, you would have seen in an NCAA football game.
Shauna Wallace, one of the people playing on the National Mall, agrees.
Just sprinting and then jogging and then sprinting and then jogging. You burn a lot of calories, I know that.
Ultimate players run several kilometers in a single game, and they can play three games back-to-back in a competition. That easily adds up to 20 or 25 kilometers. But Shauna, at least, thinks running to catch a disc almost does not seem like exercise at all.
I used to run miles and miles a day, and I didn't look forward to it. And this I look forward to every day, and it's great.
You are listening to This is America from VOA Learning English in Washington. You can find lessons, podcasts, videos, and much more at our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. The game of Ultimate may not be as popular as American football, but the Stork says Ultimate teams can now be found in many high schools and almost all colleges in the United States. And the game is played around the world.
Scandinavian teams are very strong. Swedish team has won many world championships. The Japanese program's very strong. Australia is strong. Almost all of the European countries have strong programs that participate in world championships.
But as the sport becomes more competitive, it can be harder for people to remember the spirit of the game.
There have been people who played and have been jerks, and it's required observers to come in and essentially take over the game, and that's a disappointment to everybody.
But bringing in observers is the exception. Most players seem to trust each other. And players say that trust and the culture that it creates turns Ultimate into more than just a sport.
Someone has said that Ultimate doesn't build character, it reveals it.
It's just a lot of fun, it's really good exercise, and the spirit of the game aspect of it teaches good character traits at the same time, and so it's just a win-win.
There's a reason for the sunshine sky.
I'm June Sims.
And I'm Christopher Cruz.
So high must be the season when those love lights shine all around us. So let that feeling grab you deep inside, send you reeling where your love can't hide, and then go stealing through the moonlit nights with your lover. Just let your love flow like a mountain stream, and let your love go with the smallest of dreams, and let your love show. And you know what I mean, it's the season. Let your love fly like a bird all the way, and let your love bind you to all living things, and let your love shine. And you know what I mean, that's the reason. There's a reason for the warm, sweet nights, and there's a reason for the candlelights. Must be the season when those love rays shine all around us. So let that wonder take you into space and lay you under its loving embrace. Just feel thunder as it warms your face, you can't hold back. Just let your love flow like a mountain stream, and let your love grow with the smallest of dreams, and let your love show. And you know what I mean, it's the season. Let your love fly